Face to Face with Jesus, Roy Ashbourne.
You have 45 minutes.
It's such a pleasure working with these fellas, with Jim and Bob all this week. I think that most of you do not realize how much of the time a preacher deals with trouble, with sadness, and with sorrow. And when you have the great privilege of engaging with those that you love and those who have common faith with you and common goals, together as a family should be, it becomes a real pleasure. I hope that you are not disturbed with our humor here on the platform from time to time. It in no way indicates that we take the work that we're doing less seriously, or that we in any way intend to take away from the sacredness of this occasion. Any more than when my boys lay a trap for me at home so that they can catch Daddy one way or another, that they're indicating any kind of disrespect for him. The fact that they think they can do this and that we can enjoy it together is a great compliment to me. And I feel that our associations together here this week have been a real source of pleasure to me, and I hope that you have shared them with us. It's a pleasure to help Jim out in making the announcements. Bob and I try to give him all the help we can, but he's hard to help, you know. When I, for instance, tonight, he wouldn't even give you the rest of the announcement that we've been trying to get him to give you all week. When the elder said, bring the books back if you've got them at home, and we have another phrase that goes with that, or bring a dollar and a half and we'll get another one. But he wouldn't tell you that. I noticed that they've left me a picture here on the platform tonight. I suppose this is calculated to upset me. It has to do with a suggestion box, and if you are curious about it, you can come and look at it after we're through. Drop suggestions here, it says, and they're watching him, said the phantom is striking again. I don't know whether there's something personal about that or not. It's nice to have Paul Sneed with us tonight, who was here when I was here before. However, it's a little uncomfortable sitting next to Paul on the platform. He makes me feel downright thin sitting next to him. he give you an inferiority complex. One of the problems with having me come to hold a meeting when you have a local minister is, by the time the meeting's over, people are asking the local minister if he's not putting on a little weight, because by comparison, he seems to be. We have been throughout this meeting talking about Jesus Christ, and we shall continue to. Jesus Christ, who said, I am the way, the truth, and the life. No man cometh unto the Father but by me. Jesus Christ, who epitomized himself as being the Son of God. And when I find that God is love, then I discover that Jesus Christ, as the epitome of God here upon this earth, was love where he walked. And then I read the golden text of the New Testament. For God so loved the world that he gave his only begotten Son, that whosoever believeth on him might not perish, but have everlasting life. And as we said last evening, when someone comes to me and says, what must I do to be saved? What is the gospel, the good news? I cannot but be impressed with this one passage of Scripture. The good news is that God loved me enough to send his Son into the world that I might through him be saved. That's the gospel. The good news that went forth from the hillsides of Judea was that the Son of God had come to earth, that God incarnate was here among us, and this men could scarcely understand, that Jesus Christ felt the heavy load of his responsibility here upon this earth is obvious, I think, to anyone who has read his story. But to realize what this really meant was that he felt responsible for showing to man the most magnificent power that the mind of man could possibly encompass or understand in the love of God. I read the Apostle Paul in the Roman letter where he says, I feel obligated to you people at Rome. I am a debtor to come and preach to you. I feel a responsibility to all men, male, female, bond, free. It does not matter their nationality, their color, where they happen to be, or in what condition. I am responsible to them. And it occurs to me to wonder why the Apostle Paul felt such a heavy sense of responsibility. And then as I read on, I discover it's because he felt that he himself had received from God so much love, that he had found so much in Jesus Christ that he just had to share it with somebody else. I think if there is anything lacking in the world that we live in today, it is a sense of responsibility. If you want to see it in action, that is the opposite expression of this, just drive down almost any highway. Get into traffic in town, and you'll see people who are driving these juggernauts down the street with no sense of anybody around them. Today, I followed a California trick to stop for a pedestrian. Out there in the country where I came from, if you hit a pedestrian, even out on the freeway, you know, they don't bother with a trial. They just hang you from the nearest lamppost. The pedestrians have the right-of-way. And it can cost you a lot of money if you take the right-of-way away from one. There can be a man standing over here on the corner just looking like he's contemplating, thinking about going across the street. And if you drive on without stopping, the policeman seeing you is liable to give you a ticket for taking the right-of-way away from the pedestrian. They get it out there. It may be a part of your law, but out there they take it seriously. I've seen mothers push their babies right out into three lanes of fast traffic on Highway 50 without even looking to the right or the left because they expect the traffic to stop. I wouldn't do that. There might be a Texan in the group, you know. Then you're in trouble. But they've pretty well brainwashed everybody out there to stop, you know, because they start the way that you can brainwash people the best, you know. They charge them for forgetting it. And when it hits you at the pocketbook, you can teach people pretty fast through that green, you know. This is the easiest way to educate people. And so it's sort of a conditioned response. And today I was driving down the street, Q Street, and some fellow had gotten halfway across the street. I don't know whether he started across or whether the wind had blown him that far. I don't. But he was coming across the street anyway, and he stopped there. And I just pulled up and stopped. And man alive, you would have thought I had really committed something or other from all the horn blowing I got behind me and screeching rubber tires. And I thought I was going to have three Volkswagen up the tailpipe of that thing before I could move it. They weren't conditioned to that. But I got to thinking, what if all of us felt responsible enough, even for the man in the middle of the street, that we took his safety at heart, really, and we drove as if we felt like we were responsible for the other fellow's fenders and the other fellow's safety? What if we moved as if we really felt responsible for the happiness of other people? What if we treated them in the supermarket as well as on the superhighway as though we felt responsible for their state of mind? You know, I live in a country where people live in San Jose and work in San Francisco, and the people in San Francisco work in San Jose. And so the commuter traffic is horrible. We have the longest parking lots in the world, and we call them freeways out there. What they laughingly call the rush hour is where you park until finally everything has cleared away, and then finally you inch your way home and take an Excedrin, you know, and lay down for a while before dinner. It's a terror to get from one place to the other during this rush hour. And people come home like this, you know, and as a result they sell more Compose per square inch out there than almost anywhere else. This is a serious thing. I think our whole world is getting uptight. And one of the reasons for it is because of the way we treat one another. We have no sense of responsibility to one another. If you get hurt on a downtown street, I don't know how it is here, if you limp into the drugstore and say, I'm hurt, and you can be bleeding from every pore, and tell the druggist, give me something for it, he'll say, what do you want? You say, I don't know, just give me something for it. He'll say, no, sir, you tell me what you want. Because I don't want to get involved. You tell me what you want and I'll sell it to you. But I can't prescribe because you're liable to have me in court. He wouldn't go out and help you on the side of the street. He called an ambulance for you. But we're afraid to get involved. We're afraid even to touch an individual who's hurt. More and more, we're retreating back into ourselves, and people feel less of a sense of responsibility for their fellow man. In church, the way we treat one another is irresponsibly. The way we talk about one another, among the clergy as well as among those in the pew, and perhaps it's worse up here than it is out there. The kind of language we use with reference to one another is irresponsible. When you've got an individual's character in your hands, his reputation in your hands, to treat it as irresponsibly as we do is an indication that we don't certainly feel the same thing that the Apostle Paul felt. He felt such an obligation to all mankind because of what God had done for him. He said he felt such a heavy sense that I must do something because look what I have been given. Some of these young people were in Dallas in December at the seminar there, which was magnificent. These young people gave me a new grip on our generation, a new faith in what was to be tomorrow. In seeing their zeal for Jesus Christ, it was marvelous, regardless of what some have said. And I hope that this may be repeated many times over. And one of the things I said to those young people, and I will repeat it again and again, is that we need to go out into the world not as the redeemers, but as the redeemed. We need a deep sense of obligation and a feeling of responsibility because of what Jesus Christ has done for us. But if you feel no sense of salvation, if you don't really believe that by the grace of God you are saved, if you feel every day a sense of guilt, if you feel an obligation to go to church and a duty to obey, if you have the same sense that the elder brother had, you know the story of the prodigal son. Here was a boy who came to his father one day and said, "I want you to give me what's coming to me." I've often said if his father had done that, there wouldn't have been any story. But what he meant, of course, was that he wanted his father to give him his inheritance, and his father did. He kept it there at the house for a while. He didn't leave right away, and then I suppose he began to look around and say, "Well, this joint here is not worth very much. It's a roof over my head and clothes for my back and food for my stomach, and I've got the money to furnish that myself. I think I'll split." So he took off. He went out and bought him some friends. You always do, you know. You buy your friends, whoever they are. If you buy them with gold and silver, when the gold and silver's gone, so are they. If you buy them with a good time, they'll be around as long as there are good times, but you'll suffer the hangover by yourself. A lot of young people today think it's real boss, you know, to run up against the fuzz and to get busted. And for those of you who are over 30, that means to come crossways of the police and get arrested. A lot of young men today that think that's really being it, you know, and their buddies stand around and applaud. That's great. But I have to remind them every once in a while that when finally they change suits and get a suit of blue denim with a number across the back of it, and the usher takes them from the front gate through that 32-foot-thick wall into San Quentin, there are no buddies standing around to applaud, and it's a pretty cold and lonely world. A lot of young people today that have a strange idea, you know, that because I am being applauded by those who do not know what's over on the other side of the hill, that this gives me the courage to go on and to experiment in areas that are dangerous. And we'll talk about that when we talk about drugs and some other things come Sunday. But this young man went out and bought him some friends. If you buy your friends with good faith, if you buy them with integrity, if you buy them with a mutual desire for good and for righteousness, then so long as you are that kind of person, they'll still be there. Whatever the coin you buy your friends with is going to determine how long they stay and what kind they're going to be. But this young man bought him with money, and his money ran out, and he all of a sudden found out that his friends had turned to pigs. Really, they were to start with. But the second classification of them at least didn't talk back like the first ones had, and he found them sort of uncomfortable to be with, and he was hungry, and he recognized that he'd come to the end of the road, and he said, I'll go home. Came to himself, that long journey, you know. Decided he'd go back to his father. He said, I'll go back and ask to be a servant. And so he headed home. When he got over the hill, someone said, your son's coming. And that father, whose heart had been broken as he left, with tear-dimmed eyes, ran out to meet him and held out his arms to him. And as the boy began to say, I come home to be a servant, the father cut him off to say, put the ring on his finger and the cloak on his back and kill the fatted calf. My son was lost and he's found. He was away and he's back again. If you think that God could preserve a story like that for us, and that he doesn't think that way about you when you come home, then how do you read this book? Just what kind of a God do you worship? Who is he anyway? If you think he's sitting back saying, well, now wait a minute, you haven't done this over here, and I'll wait around a while to see if you're worthy of it or not. Is this the picture you have of God? I'll wait to see if you're going to be back again next Sunday. You know, I want to be sure to know whether you're going to fulfill everything or not. No, he was coming back. And his father waited for him with open arms. And what God requires of me is that I bring it back to him totally and completely with absolute faith. But there was another brother, and somebody said, as he was down the field working, he said, what's all the ruckus up at the house? And somebody said, your brother's come back. And he wasn't too happy about this. As he went back toward the house, the father said, come in and rejoice with us. And he said, go away. The father said, what's the matter? He said, all these years have I worked for you, and you never killed a fatted calf for me. What a sad thing that this boy had had the privilege of being with his father all of these years and might have enjoyed many a cool evening looking out across the verdant fields that they had raised together and the herds that belonged to them, to rejoice together around many a campfire, to know that this is ours and we have one another. But he had been robbed of all of that because of an attitude in his own mind that out of duty I do this. This is what I have to do. I watch people sometimes coming to church, and I wonder why they come. Do you ever stand off and watch people arrive at church on Sunday morning? I don't do it to spy on people. It's because I'm concerned. But sometimes I get upstairs, and I watch them drive into the parking lot. You know, here they come. You know, he's got a hold of the steering wheel like this, you know. He's not afraid it's going to get away. I know what the problem is, because I look over, and she's going just like this, a mile a minute, you know. And you can tell that the cream they had in their coffee is curdled by the time they got to church. But then when they get out of the car, you know, they smooth down everything, including their face, and get it all into right place so they can come into the building, you know, looking the way you're supposed to look when you come through the front door. A social worker was being carried through one of the schoolrooms of third graders in a deprived area, and the teacher was trying to impress the social worker and said, look how clean these children are. She said, yes, I notice they are on the outside. And I notice how happy my people are on the outside when they walk in the door. I notice how glad they are to be at church on the outside. But I saw them when they were in the car as they came into the lot, you know, before they stuffed it all back inside where it couldn't be seen. And I know that they're there because they feel they have to be. They have to be. And this is a tragedy. It's a tragedy. If you would come to church because you feel an obligation to people, not because you feel an obligation to duty, what a difference it would make. If you came to church because you have a sense of gratitude to Jesus Christ because what he has done for you, instead of a sense of I've got to do this because that's what the rule book says, what a difference it would make. Paul felt a responsibility, a responsibility of gratitude, that he gladly fulfilled whatever he could because of what Jesus Christ had done for him. He had stood face to face with Jesus Christ, and I think this is what we need to do. We have spent too long with our noses in the concordance to look up into the eyes of Jesus Christ. We need to see him face to face. You know, one of the most productive studies that you can make of the Word of God is to go through it and turn through its pages and look into the faces of people who looked into the face of Jesus Christ. And one of my favorite sermons that I like to hear myself preach is one that has to do with talking about the people who looked at Jesus and the reactions that they gave to him. You take the time that Jesus was preaching to people and they pressed around him so, and he needed some rest, and he told the disciples quietly, he said, "You get in the boat and go over to the other side and I'll join you." It sounds like a simple thing. They got in the boat and they started out and got in trouble out there because the storm arose. But there's an interesting thing about that scripture that we haven't thought about, I'm afraid, and that is it said that the winds were contrary. And these men were fishermen. And they knew better than to get out on that sea in stormy weather. They knew better than to take out there when the winds were contrary. And yet not one of them turned around to Jesus Christ and it said, "Lord, have you checked with the weather bureau?" Not one of them said, "Have you looked at the sky? Have you felt the wind? Do you realize that there's a storm coming up?" They didn't do it. They crawled in the boat and started out. It would have been foolhardiness to do so had the command come from anyone but Jesus. I think this is an indication, evidence of the fact that these men trusted him so absolutely in so many ways that they didn't even question him when the thing he told them to do seemed to be contrary to what should have been done. Sure enough, they got in trouble out there. Boat tossing, and they were afraid. Jesus, walking on the water, turned aside for one reason, just one. He wasn't afraid they weren't going to make it. He wasn't afraid they were going to get killed or drowned. But they were afraid. They were afraid. And he turned aside because they were. Who do you think Jesus Christ is? Do you see him with a black robe on at the judgment day, making a dichotomy between sheep and goats? Is this the picture of Jesus Christ that you have? Not my Lord. He turned aside just because they were afraid. He cared that much. This is the Jesus that I stand in the front of. I don't know about yours. This is the one I believe in. He's the one that picked a Peter up and set him up on the boat and said, "Why did you think twice, little faith? Why did you think twice?" This Jesus on another time was standing with people when a father came to him whose son was ill. And I know what that means. I don't know a lot of you fathers in this audience tonight, if you've got children, I'm sure at some time in your life you have awakened in the middle of the night to a crying child, looked at a thermometer in the light, not be able to believe what you see, can't get a doctor, you're afraid. Nothing any more upsetting than this. I can stand almost anything better than I can this helpless feeling. When that little boy's temperature is getting higher and higher and I can't get a hold of a doctor. Now, if you want somebody that talks rough over the telephone, just be glad you don't get on the other end of the phone with me when this starts happening. Because I start telling listening services what I think of them, you know. Answering services. They really aren't answering services. They're just listening services. Because I think that's about as far as you get. You start trying to get a hold of a doctor, and I start saying, "Listen here, I've got a sick boy. I'm not interested in the channels. I'm not interested in the rules and regulations. I want to get a hold of the doctor, and I want him now." And that's the way this father must have felt. As he came to Jesus, he'd walked 20 miles, pushed his way through the crowd, came to Jesus and said, "I've got a sick boy. Come down to my house." He'd heard about this physician, this magician, this great miracle worker. He came to see him. Pushed his way through and said, "Come down to my house." And Jesus made a statement that he didn't even hear, and so he repeated his request. Come down to my house, I have a sick son. And Jesus looked at him and said, go home, your boy's all right. And that man turned around and walked off. That's one of the most amazing stories in the New Testament. If that had been me, under normal circumstances, I'd have said, look here, man, don't fool with me. I'm not kidding. I've got a sick boy. I didn't come all this way just to be put off. But he didn't. He turned around and walked away. Why? Because he thought less of his son than I do of mine? No, no. Because he looked in the face of Jesus. And I think any time anybody looked in his eyes, they must have known that what he said was so. To carry integrity in his countenance, kindness and love with him. You know, in the 14th chapter of John, I think we have often misread this passage of Scripture. I read it nearly always at a graveside, where Jesus Christ said, let not your heart be troubled. Let not your heart be troubled. He's talking to his disciples now. He loved them. He's worried about their upset. And he said, let not your heart be troubled. You believe in God, believe also in me. In my Father's house are many mansions. If it were not so, I would have told you. And there's where I think we need to make the emphasis. I would have told you. I love you too much to have brought you out here on a wild goose chase. If there hadn't been any more to it than this, I would have warned you at the beginning. You mean too much to me for me to bring you out here to nothing and to emptiness. I would have warned you if we were going to nothing but martyrdom. If it was to be a cause that would end at the grave, I would have told you that. That's what he's saying. If it were not so, I would have told you. But it is so. And I go to prepare a place for you. For you, because I love you. Jesus said to this man, your son's all right. I think he not only saw integrity in his countenance, but he heard love in the tone of his voice. And I think he knew that this man wasn't fooling anybody, that he wouldn't have kidded with him about something like that. I think when he looked into his eyes, he knew that here was kindness, here was gentleness, and here was love. And you know, when you see somebody that you really believe loves you, then you believe that they tell you the truth. Years ago, Brother Marshall Keebled out at the state penitentiary in Tennessee was preaching a sermon, and he said to the prisoners, you got to quit your devilment. Said, they got you in here where you can't do much devilment, and I'm glad to have. And we started back that morning. I asked him, I said, Brother Keeble, how do you get away with something like that? I said, if I'd said that, they'd have hung me from the rafters right there, guards or no guards. He said, no, Brother Roy. He said, if you show a man that you love him, you can call him any kind of liar you want to, and he'll like it. And I think that this is the reason that father didn't hesitate to turn around and walk off, because he knew that man loved him. And he wouldn't have sent him on a wild goose chase back home. As he neared his house, the servants came out, and he said, how is the boy? And they said, the boy's fine. He said, when did he start to heal? They said, he didn't start to. He was healed. All of a sudden, something strange happened. And this man's God grew up all of a sudden. When he went to Jesus, he said, come down to my house. Maybe he can heal him, but not 20 miles away. You know, his God was a little small, as Philip says. But after he realized that Jesus had done it, what a great God he had after that. How magnificent he really knew he was. You look into the faces of the people who knew Jesus. And when you do that long enough to where you can look in the face of Jesus yourself and feel what's there and no. The story of the woman taken in adultery is one of my favorite stories. The Pharisees found her in adultery. She was no innocent girl. They found her in the very act of adultery. That's pretty blatant, you know. She didn't even hide. She wasn't even hidden behind the doors. It was so public they were able to take her in the very act of adultery. And they drug her to Jesus. And they came not because they cared about her or about the law, but because they were trying to trap him, and Jesus knew it. And he didn't want to fool with them, and he knelt down and wrote in the sand, which was as much to say, go away and don't bother me. But they insisted. The law says, stone her to death. You know, we have some laws in the church that say, stone them to death, you know. So we've got people gathering rocks all the time. Stone them to death. That's what you do when you uphold the truth. I'm set for the defense of the church, you know. I'm going to defend the truth. So I got my pockets full of rocks. I'm ready to go. Same principle exactly. No difference. No difference. Jesus said, all right. He condemned her to death. He said, your judgment is correct. That's what the law says. I just have one thing to say. I'm going to qualify the executioner. Let the one without sin cast the first stone. And that bunch of preachers began to slip out, one at a time, beginning with the eldest. Don't know why they started with the eldest. Maybe it was because the youngsters, you know, not hanging back, had been goaded into it and were taking the lead, and they perhaps were closer in and couldn't get out as quick as the others. I don't know. Or it may be that it didn't dawn on them that they had been had as quick as the older ones, you know. But Jesus had fixed them there on the spot, and they began to realize it, that they had no answer. None. What a sad situation. But the amazing part of the story is that after they're all gone, the woman is still there. Wonder why. I read that story years ago, and that first dawned on me, and it was an amazement to me to realize that she was still here. She hasn't gone anywhere. Wonder why. Surely she didn't want to be here. She was brought here against her will. Long since they've turned her loose. One wonders why she didn't run like a rabbit as soon as they turned loose of her. Or at least get outside and make fun of the Pharisees who had gotten their comeuppances as they were leaving. You know, that would have been the thing you would have expected her to do. But she was still standing there, as though stunned and hypnotized. Why? I think probably because she was standing in the presence of the first gentle man she had ever seen. Remember that all of her life she had dealt with nothing but the sleazy, the lowest type of humanity. And even when the Pharisees came, she was surrounded by hypocrites. Hypocrites. Hypocrites, people that spoke from beneath their masks of righteousness and were full of filth. On the one hand were the vile fellows that she ran with, and on the other hand the super sanctimonious Pharisees, and there was no choice as far as she was concerned. And this was her picture of mankind. And now she stood in the presence of a person who had love, who was gentle and patient and kind. We need a lot of people like that in this world. You think about some of the things that are missing about this world. We talk about the militancy and about the rebellion and about the delinquency and all of the problems that exist in our world. But may I suggest that we start somewhere to work on all of these, and maybe it would be a good idea if we started with gentleness and kindness and love and patience, because that's what Paul said it was all about. And that's what it means to be a Christian, Christianos, follower of Jesus Christ, one who is like him. I cannot help, when I think of the story of this woman, I cannot help but think of the story of the man of La Mancha. I don't know whether any of you saw this musical or not, but it is taken from Cervantes' story of Don Quixote. And this Don Quixote came riding into the countryside, into this inn where there were a lot of ne'er-do-wells and drunkards and what have you. And he had the gleam of righteousness in his eyes, and he was a very kind man, and he was out to try to rid the world of evil. and replace it with righteousness. And he was going to fight against anything that was evil. But he had such great faith in his fellow man that he couldn't find any person that he thought was evil enough to fight. So he ended up fighting windmills because he had so much faith in people. And when he came into this inn where the drunkards were and the ne'er-do-wells and the thieves, there was a barmaid there who doubled as a prostitute, or a prostitute who doubled as a barmaid, whichever, I don't know. And when he saw this woman who was dressed in rags and who was filthy inside and outside, he looked at her and he called her beautiful. And he sang a song, Dulcinea. And she said, yeah, this is just another trick, you know. I know all you men. I know what you've got in your mind. I've seen all men. But he didn't even pay any attention to what she said. He just kept saying this. And all the way through the play, he keeps saying over and over again, you know, you're beautiful, you're wonderful. And she gets mad at him and everything else, you know, because she just can't understand this. She can't understand an individual. And then finally at the end, when he's dying, she comes to the bedside where he is. His family's taken him back to his fine home, and she pushes her way into the house, you know, and these people are pulling their skirts up and moving away from this dirty creature that comes in to stand at the foot of the bed. And when he dies, she goes out singing Dulcinea. Because he has said to her so often, you're beautiful, you're good, that now when she looks in the mirror, she does not see the ugly, filthy individual, but she has begun to believe that she's beautiful too. You know, when I come to Jesus, I bring him a person that's ugly, scarred with sin, debauched. You say, oh, that isn't characteristic of you. Yes, it is. I think it's because we don't really realize, like I said the other night, you know, we don't realize how bad sin really is. Like this little boy that messed up the whole room with Vaseline and had it all over the drapes and all, he couldn't see anything wrong with that room. He didn't see any reason for having draperies without Vaseline on them. As far as he was concerned, this wasn't a great tragedy, but to Mama, it was a pretty great tragedy. I think that when I bring my life full of sin to God, I do not realize how bad that really is. But he does. He does. I see how bad it is in the sacrifice that he made, Jesus Christ. And when I think that I bring a scarred and unworthy, I drag a sinful individual into the presence of the immaculate, perfect God. And as I look into his face, he says, you're perfect. You're sinless. You're pure. I love you. You belong to me. You're my child. You're a son of God. You're a prince in the household of the King. Oh, that we could stay there long enough and hear him say it often enough that we would come to believe it, so that we too would act like princes in the household of God instead of scullery maids and slaves who come to church because we have to. Then we would go out to spread the gospel, the good news. Somebody says, oh, well, that's fine for soft preaching, but we need to get back to the gospel. That is the gospel. If we're saved, that's what will save us. Not the poor, pitiful acts that we can perform, the discoveries we can make, for little things that we can do in obedience to him, as if to bring these rags to him and say, here, Lord, I'll trade this to you for a crown with pearls in it. It is by the grace of God and the love of him who died that you might live, that you will live forever and nothing else. Somebody says, well, then that means anything goes. You haven't been listening. When you love him that much, you drag yourself across miles of countryside on bloody knees to do anything you thought he wanted you to do. The commands become more meaningful because you know that they are given to you out of his love. And because you loved him, you will respond. I never saw an individual who loved Jesus Christ and sat down and read this book, who came to me and said, do you really think we have to come to church every Sunday? Never had one argue with me about whether or not he thought we ought to sing or how much we ought to give, whether or not we ought to be baptized and so forth. You don't get that argument out of people. You know, when you have an individual who's convinced of all that Jesus Christ has done for him, I hear him echo the words 2,000 years old of a man who was riding in a chariot and said, "What's to keep me from being baptized?" I have the gratitude to him that causes me to want to be everything that he wants me to be. And when I get to this point, then I feel such a deep obligation to tell everybody how wonderful he is. Not because I then become a judge and a redeemer, but because I am redeemed. He has given me salvation when I was filthy and unworthy, and still am. But I can sing Dulcinea. I can believe that I am saved, even as I look in the mirror and see a sinner, because he's told me often enough. Face to face with Jesus is where we need to stand. Look into his face. I've had so many requests for this. I'm going to do this tonight. Before I leave the sermon, in spite of the fact that Bob has told me that 45 minutes was the limit, so many of you have asked me to read this letter from a hippie that I read to the kids in Dallas, that I'm just going to read it to you here, or at least a little part of it. I'm not going to read the whole thing. But I'll tell you a little story about this boy who came out of nowhere, sort of out of the fog, and wandered into church with a hippie that I had met in San Francisco that brought him to church where I was holding a meeting one time. And he came in hesitantly at the door, barefooted, long hair, ragged clothes. With two or three other hippies, they all sat down. And some of the brethren got a little disturbed and came around to me and said, "What shall we do?" And I said, "Go over and shake hands with them. Tell them you're glad they're here." But they had a lot of room to sit. They weren't crowded where they were. And after it was over with, for some reason or other, I seemed just drawn to this boy. He sort of fascinated me, and I talked to him for a long time. And then I gave him a copy of Good News for Modern Man, this Bible, because I figured that he could read that if he was interested. And before the meeting was over, he'd read it from cover to cover. He wasn't sure he's going to come back anymore after that first time, but the next day I found him lying out under a tree reading this, and he was almost halfway through it. He was fascinated by it, you know. You imagine anybody finding the Bible fascinating? You know, when we have to get Gold Star to read three chapters a day and five on Sunday. But he found the book fascinating, and he read it. And he read it until finally he decided, "I want to be that. I want to be that." I talked to him at Christmas time, and he'd finished going through it for the third time. How long has it been since you read the New Testament all the way through, from cover to cover? Huh? Embarrassing question. I won't ask you to hold up your hands. But he wrote me some letters, and I read these to the young people to show you what can happen to an individual who suddenly, without any background and without anybody to channel him, sits down with this book to find Jesus Christ. You know, instead of finding me or you or something else, he looks for Jesus Christ. And this is one of his letters. I'm saving them, I hope, one of these days to publish these letters from a hippie. He no longer is. He's cut his hair. He's in school now. And he wants to be a preacher now. But this is part of it, what he said. It must be a challenge. For to follow Christ takes a rare man to suffer the humiliation, to quietly understand the pride of mirror people watching themselves carefully, trying to be more than the rest, trying to be more than themselves. When I feel the grace of God and a love I cannot comprehend, tears build upon my eyes. Later, they softly follow the curve of my cheek, following a course of meaning and understanding of my life. I guess I want to share the joy of opening new eyes to a new world, of caring for things uncared for, the sweet, gentle wildflowers. Where will I seek tomorrow my dream, calling to the people and hoping they will hear a greater voice than mine? And then after he had really become a Christian, and after he decided he wanted to preach, he wrote me this letter. That's just a little part of that one. I won't take time to read them all. He said, if I could find an audience on a windless hill, under cool elm trees in the fall when leaves are turning gold and falling, I would speak in a whisper about a lonely place where a man was nailed against a tree, and tell them only drowning men heard his cries. Only those who loved his truth learned of him. But I guess a place like that is hard to find. A lonely path sometimes following God, the Creator, everything to him, because of his loneliness, people turning away, a sadness because they have not the ears to listen. It would be easy to seek a life without pain, without suffering, only softness and security. Ah, but that would be your happiness. Without pain, where would we find our strength to endure or recognize the price of freedom or the beauty of life if we did not see some oppression and ugliness? I need a song, and to sing it I would need a heart. And to sing with a pure heart to make the song clear would take the grace of God. And so I turn, and in turning to him, I find the song and myself singing. These are the words of a simple boy, just now about ready to turn 21, who'd never been to church before. He didn't know the Jesus Christ that we teach him very carefully in Sunday school. He didn't know the Jesus Christ that belongs in our structured boxes. He didn't know the Jesus Christ of our rules and regulations. He found him in a strange book called the New Testament. And when he came away, he felt like that there was a burden on his heart out of gratitude to the love that Jesus Christ had for him that he just had to share with somebody else. He's a rare individual. I would commend to you a rediscovery of Jesus Christ, that you might stand face to face with him, as did a woman 2,000 years ago, transfixed at this individual different from anyone she had ever seen, not leaving when ordinarily one would have expected her to. I invite you to stand and look in the face of a man that a father heard say, "Your son is all right." And seeing the love and kindness, the truth and integrity there, turn to go back home to find it was so. I invite you to look into the face of a Jesus whom the disciples trusted every inch of the way, even when he said, "Take a boat out on the storm-tossed waters, it'll be all right." And they moved without question. I invite you to stand face to face with Jesus, and when you do, you will be transfixed and transformed and hypnotized into a new life. You can be made to believe that you are free and saved and beautiful and royal, because you are. You're not slaves and scullery maids. You're princes in the household of God. You're his saved people because he loved you that much. And when you believe that, then you can love one another. And the great joy and gratitude you can feel for that will make you feel responsible to tell all mankind of the beauty there is at the foot of the cross. Are you ready to lay your life there? Are you ready to say, "Jesus, I believe. I know that you love me. I want to bring here my life and lay it here so that I might look in your face. I want to be buried with you by baptism into your death. I want to share with you all the beauty of the resurrection. I want to be yours forever." If you do, we invite you to come to him and to his cross tonight while together we stand and sing.